truths to raising children. Kindergartens, for instance, were supposed to help with babysitting, but, as we have seen, many were far from adequate, which meant that women often had to juggle childcare with full employment. As family life was buffeted by constant campaigns, the exigencies of mobilization took a heavy toll on women, exhausting many before famine began to bite. In those villages drained of able-bodied men who joined the exodus to the city, women were left to look after relatives and dependents. Most of all, women were vulnerable because in a regime which mercilessly traded food for work, every weakness led to hunger. In the relentless drive to achieve even higher targets, at the furnace, in the field, or on the factory floor, menstruation was widely seen as a flaw. Menstrual taboos of popular religion, which feared the polluting potential of women during their periods, were swept aside seemingly overnight. Failure to come out to the field was punished, the most common form of retribution being a reduction of work points for each day of absence. Some male carders abused their positions of power, humiliating those women who asked for sick leave. Su Yingzi, party secretary of the Chengdong People's Commune in Hunan, forced those who requested a rest on the grounds of menstruation to drop their trousers and undergo a cursory inspection. Few were willing to undergo the humiliation, and many became ill as a result, several dying under the strain of laboring while suffering severe menstrual pain or gynecological problems. Expectant mothers were also compelled to work, often until the last stage of pregnancy, although they too were commonly penalized. In one district in Sichuan alone, 24 women miscarried after being compelled to work in the fields. Chun Yuanming, who objected, was kicked between her legs by the carder in charge and crippled for life. Where abusive carders assumed power unopposed, punishment could go much further. In the same Hunan commune just mentioned, pregnant women who did not appear at work were made to undress in the middle of the winter and then forced to break ice. In Xingyuan, Guangdong, hundreds of villages at a time were made to work in the middle of the winter without cotton-padded clothing. No exceptions were made for pregnant women or those with small children, and people who protested were deprived of food. In Panyu County, just outside Guangzhou, a carder grabbed seven-month pregnant Du Jinhao by her hair and forced her to the ground for not working sufficiently hard. He kept her pinned down and shouted abuse at her until she passed out. Her husband cried with fear but was powerless to intervene. After she regained consciousness, she staggered back home looking dazed, then sank to her knees, collapsed, and died. Some women were so desperate that they preferred to die. Liang Xianu, pregnant yet obliged to work in the winter, jumped to her death in a cold river. Exhausted and hungry, women became so weak that they stopped menstruating altogether. This was common everywhere, even in the cities, where women were given some medical care. In the Tianjiao district to the south of Beijing, half of all female workers in a metallurgy factory suffered from lack of menstrual periods, vaginal infections, or a prolapsed uterus. As the only available washroom was always occupied, some of the women went for months without ever washing. When combined with endless hours in a poorly ventilated environment, even political activists like Yuan Bianhua would spit blood and sometimes even lacked the strength to stand up on their own. Other studies, conducted by the Women's Federation, made similar observations. In the Beijing Electron Tubes plant, for instance, half of all 6,600 women had some form of gynecological disorder. Wu Yufeng, aged 25, had arrived at the factory as a sturdy young girl in 1956, but in 1961 suffered from headaches, irregular menses, sleeplessness, irritability, and lack of strength. Married for 5 years, she was still without children. A medical examination showed that she, like many of the other workers, had mercury poisoning. The physical decline among rural women was so extreme that many suffered from a prolapsed uterus, meaning that the womb, held in place inside the pelvis by muscles and ligaments, collapsed inside the vaginal canal. Even without overwork and lack of food, weakness can cause the uterus to sag or slip out of its normal position. This happens when women experience a difficult childbirth or suffer from a loss of estrogen. But the term refers to a variety of different stages, from a drooping cervix to the uterus coming completely outside the vagina. The latter was the syndrome observed again and again by medical authorities. The statistics they provided, even if classified, could not possibly reflect the reality, and varied from 3 to 4% of women in the countryside just outside Shanghai to 1 in every 5 working women in Hunan. The real incidence must have been much higher, given that many women would have felt too ashamed to report the condition. Many carders would have been reluctant to report medical disorders associated with starvation, and too few trained doctors actually existed in the countryside to have even a rough idea of what was happening. A prolapsed uterus was difficult to cure because the underlying causes, lack of food and lack of rest, were hard to remedy in times of famine. Even if they had money to pay the fees, many women simply did not have the time to leave their children and their work to visit a hospital, which were few and far between in the countryside. Many villagers also feared hospitals, and they resorted instead to local treatments. In Hubei, female healers used a variety of recipes, some handed down from generation to generation, to assist women suffering from gynecological problems, heating and grinding ingredients into a powder that was smeared onto the vaginal walls, and mixing medicinal herbs to cure menstrual disorders. Aunt Wang, as she was known in a village in Zhongxiang County, helped hundreds of women, her house often harboring 4 or 5 patients being nursed back to health as her husband went foraging for leaves and roots in the forest. But such traditional remedies were rarely tolerated under forced collectivization, and in the absence of effective medical care, most women simply had to bear their condition and labor on. Women were vulnerable in other ways. Socially marginalized in what remained, after all, a tough, male-oriented world, they were prone to sexual abuse. Huge power was given to local carders, while famine gradually eroded the moral fabric of society. As if this combination were not bad enough, many families were separated or broken up as menfolk joined the exodus, enrolled in the army, or labored on distant irrigation projects. As the layers of social protection surrounding women gradually crumbled, they were left almost entirely defenseless to confront the naked power of the local bully. Rape spread like a contagion through a distressed moral landscape. A few examples will suffice. 2 party secretaries of a commune in Wencheng, north of Guangzhou, raped or coerced into sex 34 women in 1960. In Hongshui County, Hebei, 3 party secretaries and a deputy county head were known to have sexually abused women routinely, one of them having had sex with several dozen. Further north, a secretary of Gujiazing village raped 27 women, and an investigation showed that he had taken liberties with almost every unmarried woman in the village. Li Dengmin, party secretary of Kumo, raped some 20 women, 2 being underage. In Lieyang, Hunan, girls as young as 11 or 12 were sexually abused. In Xiangtan, a carder set up a special team, Zhuan Yedi, of 10 girls whom he sexually abused at whim. And even if women were not raped, they were subjected to sex-specific humiliations, as collectivization swept aside the customary moral values of sexual restraint and bodily propriety. China was undergoing a revolution, turning upside down moral codes of behavior passed down from generation to generation, which led to perversions that would have been unthinkable before 1949. In a factory in Wugang County, Hunan, local bosses forced women to work naked. On a single day in November 1958, more than 300 went about their jobs in the nude. Those who refused were tied up. A competitive system was even devised by which the women most eager to strip were granted a reward, the top gift consisting of cash to the value of 50 yuan, more or less equivalent to a month's salary. While some women may have embraced the opportunity to advance their careers, many were no doubt repelled, although nobody dared to speak their mind. But a few did write. After some of the women fell ill, Hunan can be bitterly cold during the winter, a series of anonymous letters were sent to Mao Zedong. Whether he actually read these letters, we do not know, but someone highly placed in Beijing phoned the provincial committee in Changsha and demanded an inquiry. The factory leaders, it came to light in the course of an investigation, had apparently encouraged the women to take off their clothes in a spirit of emulation which aimed to break feudal taboos. Seemingly anything could be justified in the name of emancipation. Equally crude and humiliating were the nude parades, which happened across the country. Women, occasionally men, were made to march through the village entirely naked. In Suichang County, Zhejiang, men and women accused of larceny were stripped naked and paraded. Zhu Moying, a grandmother aged 60, was forced to undress and then lead the procession by beating a gong, despite the pleas for pardon from fellow villagers. Some of the abused women felt too ashamed to return to their homes. 24-year-old Zhu Renxiao, stripped and paraded for petty theft, felt too ashamed to face people and asked to be moved to another village. She killed herself when her request was turned down. In another small village in Guangdong, the militia stripped two young women and tied them to a tree, using a flashlight to explore one of the girls' private parts, and drawing a large turtle, symbol of the male organ, on the other woman's body. Both committed suicide. Less often mentioned in the archives or in interviews, but part of a distinct social trend in any famine, was the trade in sex. Women provided favors for almost anything, from a morsel of food and a better job to a regular but illicit relationship with a man who could offer some sense of security. Most of these transactions went on undetected, but there was also a whole underworld of prostitution which the authorities tried to monitor. One correctional facility in Chengdu kept well over 100 prostitutes and delinquent female children. More than a dozen were sex workers who had been re-educated after the communist victory in 1949, but refused to reform themselves. Wang Xingji, who went by the nickname of Old Mother, in turn introduced other women to the trade. Some of the new sex workers formed bands with male thieves and roamed the country, travelling to Xi'an, Beijing, and Tianjin to make a living. A few worked independently, one or two even regularly handing over money to their parents, who turned a blind eye to the source of the income. Village women also offered their bodies for food after escaping to the city, as we have already seen. The logical extension of this trade in sex was bigamy, as country girls lied about their age or their marital status in order to secure a husband in town. Some were only 15 or 16, well below the legal age of marriage. Others were already married but committed bigamy to survive. A few were prepared to abandon their children from a previous marriage, but not all of them deserted their families. Some returned home only a few days after the wedding had taken place. Trade in sex, flimsily disguised by the pretense of marriage, was even more common in the countryside. In one closely studied Hebei village, the number of weddings increased sevenfold in 1960, the worst year of the famine. Women poured into the village from distressed areas, marrying for goods, clothes, or food for relatives. Some were as young as 16. Others left soon after the wedding. A few of the women introduced other family members to the groom, resulting in half a dozen cases of bigamy. And then there was trafficking in women. From Inner Mongolia, for instance, teams spread out over the country, hauling back hundreds of women every month. Most came from famished Gansu, a few from Shandong. Some were mere children, others were widows, although married women were also trafficked. The victims ranged across all social categories, including students, teachers, and even carters. Few came voluntarily, and some were traded several times. 45 women were sold to a mere 6 villages in less than half a year. Always marginalized, sometimes humiliated, invariably exhausted and often abandoned by the men, women, in the end, were the ones who had to make the most heart-rending decision, namely how the meagre food ration should be divided. This was not so at the onset of famine, as men were normally in charge and demanded to be fed first. In the same way that women were systematically given fewer work points than men under collectivization, a patriarchal society expected that priority be given to the feeding of all male members of the household. As men provided, women abided, a cultural imperative that dictated that even in normal times, women were given a smaller share of the food. And as famine took over, women were deliberately neglected in the interests of male survival, a choice that was justified on the grounds that the entire family ultimately depended on the ability of men to go out and find food. But once the men were gone, women had to endure the agony of their starving children without being able to help. Not all could live with the constant crying and pleading for food by their children, made so much more unbearable by the stark choices they had to make about the distribution of scarce resources. Liu Xieliu, deprived of food for 6 days as punishment for being too sick to work, finally succumbed to the pangs of hunger and devoured the ration allocated to her child, who soon started crying of misery. Unable to suffer the torment, she swallowed caustic soda to put an end to her life. There is no doubt that the emotional distress and physical pain, to say nothing of the self-abasement and humiliation many had to endure, were enormous. And much of this was a direct consequence of sex discrimination. But historians have shown that in many other poor, patriarchal societies, women did not die in much greater numbers than men, however problematic recorded rates of mortality may be. In the Bengal famine, male mortality even exceeded that of females, leading the historian Michel McAlpin to write that females may be better able than males to withstand the trials of a period of famine. As we have seen in previous chapters, women excelled at devising everyday strategies of survival, from foraging in the forest and preparing substitute foodstuffs to trading on the black market. In the end, the greatest victims of the famine were the young and the elderly. Chapter 30. The Elderly. Life in the countryside has always been tough in China, and strict observance of traditional notions of filial piety would simply have been beyond the reach of all but the wealthiest households before the communist takeover. Proverbs suggested the limits of respect for the elderly in traditional society. With 9 sons and 23 grandchildren, a man may still have to dig a grave for himself. Even if children were the family pension, the elderly continued to rely for the most part on their own work to eke out a frugal life. And while some prestige may have been associated with old age, in a society that heavily emphasized earning power, many people must have felt a decline in respect when moving into old age. As elsewhere, the elderly feared loneliness, impoverishment, and abandonment, in particular those who were more vulnerable than others, the ones without family. But in most cases, before 1949, they could count on a measure of care and dignity, their mere survival commanded respect. Yet by the time of the Cultural Revolution, a completely different set of values seemed to dominate, as young students tortured their teachers and Red Guards attacked elderly people. When did the moral universe turn upside down? While the party was steeped in a culture of violence, fostered by decades of ruthless warfare and ceaseless purges, the real watershed was the Great Leap Forward. As villagers in Machung complained, the people's communes left children without their mothers, women without their husbands, and the elderly without relatives. These three family bonds were destroyed as the state was substituted for the family. As if this were not bad enough, collectivization was followed by the agony of famine. As hunger stalked an already distressed social landscape, family cohesion unraveled further. Starvation tested every tie to the limit. The prospects for the elderly without children were particularly grim. So much so that many traditionally tried to join monasteries or nunneries, while others established fictitious ties of kinship with adopted children. These age-old customs were swept away with collectivization. In the summer of 1958, retirement homes for the childless elderly appeared throughout the villages of rural China. At the peak of the Great Leap Forward, over 100,000 of them were reportedly established. Abuse was rife. Some of the elderly were beaten. Even those with only a few meager possessions were robbed, and others were put on a slow starvation diet. In Tongzhou, just outside Beijing, the head of the retirement home systematically stole food and clothes earmarked for the elderly, condemning the inmates to a winter without heating or cotton-padded jackets. Most passed away as soon as frost appeared, although their bodies were not buried for a week. Further south, in Xianghai County, Guangdong, the entire village was put to work in the absence of able-bodied men, who were all conscripted on a distant irrigation project. The elderly slaved day and night, a 70-year-old going for 10 days without any sleep at all. A tenth of the village died in the winter of 1958-9, the majority of them children and those elderly people kept in retirement homes. In Chongqing County, Sichuan, the director of one home made the residents work 9 hours a day, followed by 2 hours of study in the evening. In another case, the elderly were forced to work throughout the night, according to the demands of militarization. Slackers were tied up and beaten or deprived of food. In Hunan, too, they were routinely tied up and beaten. In Chengdu, in the winter, the inmates of one retirement home slept on a muddy floor. They had no blankets, no cotton-padded clothes, no cotton hats, and no shoes. In Hengyang, Hunan, the medicine, eggs, and meat reserved for the elderly went to the carders in charge of the home. As the cook succinctly put it, "What point is there in feeding you? If we feed the pigs, at least we will get some meat." In the province as a whole, by the end of the famine, a mere 1,058 had managed to survive in the remaining 7 homes. Many of the homes collapsed almost as soon as they had appeared, besieged by the same systemic problems of funding and corruption which undermined kindergartens. The childless elderly who were abandoned to the care of collective entities had to scramble for survival by the winter of 1958-9. But life outside the retirement home was no better. Just as children were treated like adults, the elderly, too, had to prove their worth to the collective, as rations in the canteen were dished out against work points. Hunger was never simply a matter of lack of resources, but rather of their distribution. Confronted with shortages in both labour and food, local carders all too often decided to exchange the one for the other, in effect creating a regime in which those unable to perform at full capacity were being slowly starved to death. The elderly, in short, were dispensable. And just as children were harshly chastised even for small misdemeanours, so the elderly were subjected to an exacting regime of discipline and punishment, in which the family often shared. In Liuyang County, Hunan, a 78-year-old who complained about working in the mountains was detained and his daughter-in-law ordered to hit him. After she had refused, she was beaten bloody. Then she was ordered to spit on the old man, who had also been beaten to a pulp. He died shortly afterwards. Inside the family, the fortunes of the elderly depended on the goodwill of their children. All sorts of quarrels developed in times of famine, but new bonds also developed. Jiang Guihua remembered that her mother did not get on well with her blind grandmother. The grandfather was a cripple. Both were dependent on others for food, but also for help in getting dressed and using the toilet. Jiang Guihua was the one to provide help, as her mother often lost her temper and tried to cut their food rations. But there was little she could do, and after a while her grandparents died of eating soil. They were buried without a coffin, wrapped in some straw and lowered into a shallow pit. In the end, when everybody left the village in a desperate search for food, only the elderly and the handicapped stayed behind, often unable to walk. In Dangyang, Hubei, 7 people were all that remained of a once lively and noisy village, 4 being elderly, 2 blind, and 1 handicapped. They ate leaves from the trees. Part 6. Ways of Dying. Chapter 31. Accidents. Poor safety was endemic to the command economy, despite detailed labor legislation and meticulous rules on every aspect of industrial work, from the provision of protective clothing to the standards of lighting. An extensive network of labor inspectors, from the Federation of Trade Unions, the Women's Federation, and the Communist Youth League, as well as from the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Labor, periodically toured workshops, monitored health hazards, and looked into the living standards of workers. They operated under huge political pressure and often preferred to turn a blind eye to widespread abuse, but they could file hard-hitting reports. Despite this vast apparatus, factory managers and team leaders, regardless of their personal sympathies for their workers, remained obsessed with increased output. On the ground, both zealots and dawdlers set the tone. Party activists cut corners, reduced standards, ignored safety, and abused the workforce as well as every piece of equipment in their relentless quest to meet higher production targets. On the factory floor and in the fields, ordinary people tried to counter the blow of each production drive with the force of collective inertia. But widespread apathy and negligence, while easing the pressure from above, also had a corrosive effect on safety in the workplace, as people abdicated responsibility for anything that did not concern them directly. And as collectivization produced growing shortages of food, clothes, and fuel, much riskier techniques of self-help appeared, from lighting a stove in a thatched hut to stealing safety equipment, leading in turn to more accidents. Worker fatigue only made matters worse, as people fell asleep by the furnace or at the wheel. To this should be added a simple, if grisly, calculation. Failure to fulfill a target could cost a manager his career, while violation of labor safety attracted a mere slap on the wrist. Life was cheap, costing a lot less than installing safety equipment or enforcing labor legislation. After all, what were a few deaths in the battle for a better future? As we have seen, Foreign Minister Chen Yi, comparing the Great Leap Forward to a battlefield, was adamant that a few industrial accidents were not going to hold back the revolution. "It's nothing," he said with a shrug. Take the case of fire. We have noted how the Ministry of Public Security estimated that some 7,000 fires destroyed 100 million yuan in property in 1958, the year of the Great Leap Forward. One reason for the extent of the damage was a lack of firefighting equipment. Most of the fire hoses, pumps, extinguishers, sprinklers, and other tools had been in